which they call a WRA, Weapon Replaceable Assembly. So, you have 105 LRUs, every one of these LRUs. The good news on what the B-1 did was to make a decision, and this was a decision made by Rockwell. Rockwell made a decision that they're going to save a whole lot of weight of copper wire on the airplane by not wiring the majority of the power at 110 volts, 120 volts, but by wiring it at 240 volts, three-phase, 400 cycle. So they doubled the voltage, half the amount of copper required. Sounds like a great gain. And higher voltages mean power supplies became simpler and whatever. Sounds great. Okay. For years and years and years, that input connector that Rich was talking about earlier, there's an equivalent on every one of these LRUs, which is called the dirty box. In other words, all power coming into the box flows through this device in the wall, which is doing EMI protection. In other words, any signals emitted in the box can't be radiated out of those wires. So it's a kind of a Pi filter network, series inductor, shunt capacitors. The shunt capacitors, for years and years, were 1 microfarad oil-filled capacitors. I think their rating was something like 400 or 500 volts. So the oil-filled capacitor had the right voltage rating. The oil-filled capacitor was a steel can with 2 radial leads coming out of it. The thing was about, 3/4 of an inch, 7/8 of an inch in diameter, and about 2 inches long. 1 microfarad capacitor, and that was from each line to ground as a bypass capacitor on all of the power input on all of these boxes. And as I said, those things have been used for years and years, had ridiculous reliability, and now you're running at twice voltage. Because their voltage rating was proper, everything was hunky-dory in people's mind.
Repeater, timeout.
So a whole lot of these boxes were manufactured that way. Approximately a year downrange, we started hearing mysterious failures of explosions occurring in the boxes. The oil-filled capacitors were exploding, but we weren't exceeding their voltage rating. How in the world was that happening? Well, a year later, after an awful lot of investigation, we discovered that the oil-filled capacitors were made by having the pairs of plates inside were separated by paper. Paper and oil makes a very good dielectric material, and the paper is an automatic self-healing process most of the time. And you cannot arc across paper unless you hit more than 200 volts peak. But we were running them at 240 volts RMS. And so therefore, an awful lot of the self-healing process went away. And so we were getting breakdown occasionally.
Tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL, repeater system.
We were getting breakdown within these things. And when the breakdown occurred, it would carbonize a certain area between the plates. It would carbonize a certain area of the paper dielectric. And it would start boiling the oil in that area, and the sealed can, steel can, with oil and glass seals where the leads come out, was a completely sealed container with no escape valve. So the steel can exploded, and it gave you an amount of power that was similar to a 2-inch salute. And it made a lot of damage, scared the daylights out of people, made a lot of noise. As loud as a 2-inch salute, as much damage as a 2-inch salute firecracker. And lots of these boxes started doing that. And there were all kinds of theories as to what was causing it. The voltage by itself on these quality-made Mallory capacitors wouldn't have caused the failure. And the theory came down the line that, we got occasional transients that'll go to a higher voltage for a very brief period of time. And no one could confirm that that was taking place and that was the causative agent. I decided to do an investigation. I made myself a spark gap generator that would put a very short spike of voltage across the capacitor at the same time that the 240 volt AC was impressed on the capacitor. So I'm spiking away with this thing, and I suddenly started thinking, hey, when that finally blows, it's going to make shrapnel. I better protect myself. I decided to put a very thick layer of plexiglass inside of a steel container where this test was taking place, and now I could look through the plexiglass. I think I was looking through 3/4 of an inch thickness of plexiglass into this container while I'm doing this test. My goodness, am I glad that I decided to do that. because when it finally let go, the shrapnel that came out of there embedded itself into that plexiglass. And if that had been firing toward my body, I would have been damn unhappy. So, and what was the replacement? Well, we eventually decided to replace them with ceramic capacitors of the same rating. And that wasn't a cure-all, because the ceramic capacitors, although they give you the pulse protection, they don't have that exploding characteristic, they're microphonic. When a spike of voltage goes across a ceramic capacitor, it is a kind of a loudspeaker that makes a mechanical noise. And now you got to worry about the shock effects that it creates throughout the system. So the amount of engineering that's required in safe power systems at times gets a lot more elaborate than first meets the eye. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters, K2RIW on the TechNet.
A question along a similar line here about power line surge suppressors.
You got it, Joe.
Do they use transorbs, or have they ever used transorbs in like a regular power line surge suppressor strip that you buy in any of these type of electronic places, Home Depot and the like, or do they use transorbs in those type of devices?
That's for you, Glenn.
I think most of the stuff that you'll find available to you right now still has MOVs in them, but there again, I think little by little they're being replaced by transorbs. What the actual ratio of them are right now, I'm not really sure, but I do know that most everything brand new coming out with new UL files, so keep in mind, anything from 2006 forward, because a lot of products can still be built today, as long as they're grandfathered in from before 2006, they can still be still have MOVs in them and still be sold. KG2QIQ.
So if I understand you correctly,
what you JU?
If I JU recognize, if I understand you correctly, Glenn, and you're a little bit noisy, the UL rating itself on a modern piece of equipment doesn't yet guarantee that it's transorb instead of MOV. Is that true, Glenn?
Is this better, Dick? I'm trying to find a location here with the HT where I'm coming in a little bit clearer.
That's a lot better. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, what happens with UL files? Basically, a UL file is basically something, a criteria that's met at a certain time of manufacture when it's first going through its qualification. So when something has a UL label on it, it's only as good as the standards that were available at the time that it got its rating. But that rating or that sticker that's on there could go back many, many years. So even though you're buying a brand new product, if it hasn't actually been redesigned or something that file been updated recently, more than likely it can have a lot of grandfathered things in it that go back quite a ways.
That ain't good. What do you trust? If Joe was buying a surge protector type multi-contacting device for his sensitive computer, other than taking it apart and look inside and look at the model numbers on the surge protecting devices, are they transorbs instead of MOV? I think you're telling me there's almost no other way he can know what he's buying. Back to you, Glenn.
I would say that that's fair to say, but there's a saving grace to this, that one of the advantages are something that you pointed out earlier, that most of the circuits that are basically being used here in the United States are 115. So if you've got surge suppression on a 115-volt circuit, you've got basically some margin, because most of those MOVs are rated for 264 volts, 1.5 times greater. So you're talking like, relatively, it's not unusual to see ratings of like 375 volt ratings on those MOVs. So they're up there. So they'll last a while. But there again, it's one of those things where, do you want to use a surge suppressor that you've had in service for 10 years? I would suggest that if it's something that you're going to leave on in the house while you walk away and you go to work and there's nobody home, I would probably want to replace them every couple of years or so, if you understand what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
M2EO. Rich recognized. There was another person who checked in. Who was that?
Hey, gentlemen, it's M1UJU, located in Newtown, Connecticut. Name here is Alan. I can check in as an AHA. I've been listening for quite a while. I guess I'll turn it back to the net, and you can turn it back to me, or however things are working here. Good evening.
in right now, UJU from Connecticut. Alan, go ahead.
Checking out this transorb thing that you guys were talking about. I'm looking at the site now, and I don't know, it's odd. It says that the site, if you'd like to purchase this domain name, it's up for sale. That's kind of odd. Looks like interesting products, though, as far as surge suppression and whatnot. Just kind of checking it out, absorbing all the good information you guys are giving here. Great signal over here across the pond, by the way. Back to the net, 10-1 UJU.
Very fine, Alan. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I'm going to order some transorbs tonight because, like I said, I got to put an order in anyway. Glenn, I know I'm taxing your memory, but do you happen to know a case style, like, you know, transistors TO3, TO5, TO92, what type of case, if that's the way they made it, that I can, cause my application wouldn't be surface mount. It would be wire leads because my equipment, you know, is all this Collins stuff and other equipment that's point-to-point wiring. So I need something that I can wire, you know, across a 3AG fuse holder to the other side of the line. Do you happen to know what they call that case style?
Unfortunately, Rich, I don't off the top of my head, especially for the through-hole stuff right now. I can probably think of a few guesses, but it would probably just be too confusing. But what I would suggest to you is this. When you start looking them up and you start and you want to order some, the most common ones you're going to find are like the 5-watters. And in most cases, the 5-watters will handle a tremendous amount, provided that they're set up for the correct voltage. So if you're getting one that's got like a, you know, 375-volt rating on it and, you know, peak rating and, basically, it's a, you know, 5-watt package. Usually, that'll take care of most problems that you'd have. I mean, you can put them in the water, but just, you know, maybe you can order some 10-waters as well. But most of the cases, I think the 5-watt packages will do it for you.
And are you saying that the 5-watt, he could suspend it on his leads and air, wouldn't have to go through the heat sink process for his particular application?
Yeah, exactly, because in most cases, this thing is supposed to be sitting there with, like, zero dissipation because it's basically a non-conducting Zener diode. So the only time that it's going to really do anything is when, you know, a motor turns on and off or something happens. This thing just momentarily clamps, and then it lets go on the next cycle. So, I mean, it's just a very, very fast, transient kind of a thing. So in most cases, there's no noticeable heat.
And now, Rich,
you'd probably be looking for something with axial leads on it.
That makes some sense. Ed chimed in here. I heard him on the input, even though he's come through the machine. And, Rich, Ed wants to make sure you're not putting it across the fuse holder. You're putting it maybe from the non-hot lead of the fuse to ground, but you're not putting it across the fuse holder. You don't want this transorb to bypass your fuse, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Rich.
I know. I realized when I said that was a poor choice of words. What I meant was from the far side of the fuse across the line to the neutral. So if something goes wrong with the transorb, where it should short, the fuse will blow, hopefully. That's what I meant.
Now, in the past, you guys have got some real smarts when it comes to automobiles. I've got a 1999 Toyota Corolla CE. And I did something dumb on equipment that I connected to the cigarette lighter, and I blew a 7.5-amp fuse. I eventually found the fuse hidden on that fuse panel that's in the passenger compartment to the lower left of the steering wheel. There's something there that looks like an ashtray. You take that ashtray out and you're looking at a fuse panel. And I rapidly found the 7.5-amp fuse. That's good. While I'm there, I found a black unpluggable device that's approximately 3/4 inch square and about 1/4 inch thick, with two thick blades to it. It looks like a fuse, a supersized fuse, but with an ohmmeter, it's an open circuit. My best guess is maybe it's a bypass capacitor. The markings on it are just a bunch of mysterious numbers. Nothing really to identify the darn thing. Just mysterious Toyota numbers. on this Toyota motor automobile on that fuse panel. One guess I got from somebody is that it's a bypass capacitor giving surge protection to protect the computer that's in the car, the emission control computer. Other than that, I don't know what it is. It can't be a relay. It's only got three, it's only got two leads. It can't be a fuse because it's an open circuit and the car runs without it. It's not a flasher because when I unplug it, all the directional signals and the flashing works right and the car drives like normal. I'd love to know what that thing is. I know if I visit my my Toyota dealer, maybe he'll be able to tell me. And maybe if I visit a library and get a wiring diagram for the car, maybe it'll tell me. But on the back of the cigarette lighter, it looks like an ashtray. The back of the ashtray-like device that unplugs from the wall, let me drop, which gives you access to the fuse panel, all of the individual fuses, their fuse rating and their location is indicated. This black thing is not indicated on the diagram. So it's an unpluggable thing with two wide blades, and I don't know what it is. Does anybody have a guess? Give me your call letters, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Why don't you go on to Google and type Toyota part number in the part number?
Okay, I heard Rich's suggestion. On the input being covered up was Ed, EAV, what did you just say? Okay, so he said he's not coming through the machine. Either you're too weak or you don't have your PL turned on, I don't know what. You're not coming through the machine, but he says the owner's manual that's in the glove compartment has a fuse map. And there is a fuse map on the back of the panel itself, which doesn't show this thing. It doesn't look like it's intended to be a replaceable item. So if it's not on the map that's on the cover for the fuse panel, I'm doubtful that it's going to be in the owner's manual fuse map. But I'm going to look there. And if I don't find it there, what's your next suggestion, Ed? EAV, RIW? You're absolutely right. I think you accidentally turned off the PL. Not a single peep comes through the machine. Lucky for you, I'm hearing you on the input. So you mysteriously turned it off. Next time you get through a street light where you can see your instrument panel on your handy-talkie, you might find that out. And when it comes to the service manual on Toyota, they are notoriously difficult to get a hold of. If you're a person who runs a repair shop, you can get a service manual. I think no other human being is allowed to have one. So that's a little bit of a problem. The next thing I'm going to do is put it into some kind of a capacitance measuring machine to see if it is a capacitor. That's my next best guess. By the way, it is a potted assembly. In other words, the black box that it's in is a five-sided box, and the two heavy leads come out of the side that has what looks like a very smooth epoxy that's holding it all together inside. So my next guess is a capacitor. It doesn't look like a fuse. You don't build a fuse with an epoxy cover over it, so to speak. Anyone with any further questions or comments or suggestions, give me your call letters, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, did I fix it?
Yes, you did. Now you're coming through.
Is it possible that it's a launching pad, an MOV? When it blows, it goes in an organized manner out into orbit?
Could be. And if it does come flying out of its... in that direction, it'll come right straight toward, let me call it my stomach, but you know what I really mean. It would make me unhappy if it started flying out of there. So let's hope it's not an MOV. Okay, I'm going to give one more listen if there's anyone else with questions or comments. If not, Mel's going to tell us what kind of mail he's had this week. Anybody with any further questions or comments? And let the machine thoroughly drop for a couple of seconds, so we can pick up anybody out of the area that might want to say a few words to us. K2RIW on the TechNet listening. There being no sounds, Mel, you've got it. And let's hope those people will slowly learn how to use their digital TV converters and stop blaming you for what the FCC caused. And let's hope you've had some slightly more pleasant email this week. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah, these converters is still somewhat confusing for a lot of people.
And I guess it's going to continue for some time. What they're going to resolve, what really will have to take place in certain areas around here, I have no idea. I don't know what exactly is going on, but, you know, with talk between the FCC and the local congressman or whatever, you know, or what they're going to eventually have to come up with. But the main problem seems to be that these cable companies will not put in basic cable in a number of these places without collecting a fee. So I don't know how possibly they're going to get people to pay for something that they were getting for free, and I just see it at an impasse right now, Dick. Over.
Yeah, there is no glamour fix for that one. I guess it's possible for an enthusiastic relative of a person who's in this assisted living center to establish some kind of a rabbit ear-like antenna in the window of the building facing the direction of the Empire State Building and wiring that to some number of digital converter boxes so that at least some of the digital channels will be receivable. I mean, half a loaf is better than none, but this is far from a great solution. It's only going to help a few people at a time. And to put a community antenna television receiving antenna system in the Hold On building is almost as bad as establishing cable television in the building. Somebody's going to have to make an investment before it takes place. And who's going to be willing to make that investment? Sounds like an almost no-win. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Let me tell you what the main problem is with antennas over there. There's a train runs right through, an elevated train runs through that part of Brighton. And that's where the problem is. The train goes by, and whatever marginal reception that they are getting on HD, that train, anywhere it gets even near close, it seems to start creating a problem. And then as the train goes by, it's a complete loss of reception. It was real marginal, you know, before, like you say, you could tolerate flickering and ghosts and snow conditions, but of course, that this HD is very unforgiving. So this is the main problem. You can't really go to any kind of simplified antenna such as you just proposed. It's going to take a lot more than that. And so this is where the whole problem really is existing right now. They just can't come up with any way that you're going to be able to fix this problem without it being, as you say, a cost over.
I'm guessing that some of the windows of some of the residents are right at the level of the elevated train. And the train comes along, if it's a subway train, and the Brighton IRT, I'm going to guess, and that goes to New Lodge Avenue or whatever, and it is arcing and sparking and doing all kinds of nasty things as far as digital television reception is concerned. I guess an antenna, if the building is tall enough to be taller than the elevated train, would give you a stronger signal, but still it's going to be looking into that arcing and sparking. Wow. Are any of my guesses even close, Mel? K2KEY, K2RAW?
Hey, Dick, you got the stuff about the subway all wrong, although the technology about the RF is fine. But don't say the IRT in Brighton.
Is it IND or BMT? If I was a New Yorker and I had a little bit of smarts, what would I call it, Ed?
It's the Brighton line. It used to be BMT, but they dropped all of those in 1967 when they combined the BMT and the IND. The IRT is a term that they dropped, but because a narrower and the IND/BMT and the IRT are not compatible, it remains separate, but they've dropped all that terminology. You will not find that anywhere anymore.
Okay, so it's the Brighton line. Alrighty. I'm slowly getting smarter. You got it, Mel.
Actually, that's what it is now. It's Brighton line. My day when I traveled every day with the subway to go to Brooklyn Tech in downtown Brooklyn, I took the Brighton, the BMT. And, no, so basically it's a busy line, too. There are trains coming and going because when it passes through that elevated area that runs the complete length of Brighton Beach Avenue, it then goes to Coney Island, and then Coney Island is the yard where the trains turn around or whatever, you know, the train starts back the other way. So it's near that area. That area of stations are near it towards the end of the line. So it's kind of a busy, you know, area as far as train traffic. I don't think you get more than a couple of minutes where their possibility is that you're not going to have, you know, a train either coming or going. And as you said, there are a number of the apartments above the stores or down the block from the stores that are basically in line with the train or the elevated line itself. The elevated line itself presented a lot of problems. Now, way back, you were mentioning color TV and the Gaussian. You had a color TV anywhere over that area, the early color TVs, and they just couldn't stay in conversion. You needed to really do... You really have to, you know, demagnetize, degauss them, and fool with those TVs. There were constant problems over there. So now, here it goes again with the problems of people living in that area. Over.
Yeah, a buddy of mine who has done some work for the MTA told me that the third rail of the subway system runs on something like 600 volts, and I vaguely remember 5,000 ampere capability. Boy, that can make some magnetic field. I think you're saying the magnetic field is strong enough to affect the conversion of a tricolor type color television receiver, a CRT. Wow. How about you, Mel?
Well, you remember the early version ones, before they had the Gaussian that comes on when you turn the set on, you know, for a short period of time. The Gaussian said every time you turn the set on, that's what came about. There were retrofits, of course, on a lot of TVs where they gave you, they put the Gaussian on. In fact, the first... you know, of the color TV, some of the early ones, you had a button right in the back of the set on top there. You push the button, and they tell you push the button for about a couple of seconds and hold it and let go, and that will fix up your TV. There was a number of these kits that came out, but there were areas over there. It seems like that just wasn't powerful enough. You had to have one of those rings, as we were talking about, how the Gaussian ring would be very popular with both, you know, servicemen and some of the customers. But they came out with a cheaper one for people, you know, to buy in a Radio Shack. It was one like about a 6-inch plastic casing one with a button built into it, Dick, built right into the plastic casing. Over.
So MUF with a comment. MUF, go ahead.
Just for your information, that last comment you made on 1,000 amps, I think you should triple that. Some of the breakers in the Steinway Street tube, when these trains pull uphill with the air conditioning running, some of them are set for over 15,000 amps.
Impressive. 15,000 amps, 600 volts, all going through those shoes of the multiple carriages of the train. Boy, can that create a magnetic field, arcing and sparking and coming along at what, second or third floor level of a local apartment building. And I guess some of those residences can be how close to the actual train track itself? Maybe only 200 feet away. What do you think, Mel?
Go up Brighton Beach Avenue, there's some buildings that it looks like you can almost leap across from the tracks to the building. I mean it. There's not a much of a gap. It's just like an alleyway, sort of a narrow alleyway. If you look at that construction of the early days there that they got away with, actually putting the buildings as close to... Actually, if you look at the edge of the track, you're walking on the sidewalk, at the edge of the sidewalk along just where the street level, you know, street is, the gutter is, and you look up, you look at the track, and so it's the width of the sidewalk from the track to the building deck over.
I'd say about 25 feet is a typical answer.
Oh, no, 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 no. I would say no more than about 12, 10 feet.
Wow. Boy, that's close. Amazing. Now, thank goodness these subway trains are nice and quiet. Can you imagine living in a residence where the rumble and noise and sparking and arcing of a subway train goes by, what, every 5 or 10 minutes? All day long, and in quite a significant number of times through the night. Can you imagine living in that residence? I know you can get used to it. Human beings are adaptable, but that's an awful lot to adapt to. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, Dick, for years I would wake up in the middle of the night with a start when I didn't hear the Brighton line pulling into Stillwell Avenue.
So you're saying if you didn't hear the train, you knew something was wrong and it would wake you up?
USL.
Other than that, your body was tuned to ignore it and you would sleep right through it?
Took me till about 3 a.m. the first night and it never bothered me again. But then again, we were up on the 13th floor, so that helped a bit.
Wow. Back to you, Mel.
Now, part of the line runs, the Brighton line now starts running after it comes out of Brighton Beach, starts heading north. And it's above ground, you know, it's about somewhat elevated, and it runs along a whole area for all the way to, to almost Prospect Park, where it starts then to go below, you know, grade level. And the houses that were built, there's a lot of one- and two-family houses that their backyard is, that's where you may be 20 feet, you know, your backyard from the back of your house to the tracks could be 20 feet at that point, 25 feet. But along Brighton Beach Avenue, it's just the width of the sidewalk. In other words, you're walking on a sidewalk, literally looking up at the tracks that go over.
Now, in the early days of, late 1950s, early 1960s, when the Myrtle Avenue L existed, and it went by Pratt Institute, and I've ridden that Myrtle Avenue L on a couple of occasions. When I stood on a subway platform waiting for a train to come along, the ground that I was standing on, the platform I'm standing on, I'm, 1.5 floors above, 1.5 stories above the street, seemed to me like it was almost continuously moving. That if I exaggerate, I could say that whole great big long elevated line was one great big slinky spring. And somewhere a mile or 10 miles away from me, a train was either accelerating or decelerating, stopping or starting, and shaking that whole system. And those H-beams that went down to the street didn't have crisscross bracing. They were just pure vertical columns. And therefore they could cantilever and swing back and forth. You guys who have ridden the Brighton Beach line, and you stand on a platform, an elevated platform, did you also feel that funny phenomena, almost like a minor earthquake continuously going? Ed first, Mr. EAV, K2RIW.
No, I did. In the West 8th Street station, where I would occasionally get on or off, is a double-decker. You got the D train under the Brighton line, and I don't recall ever noticing any vibration at all, except when a train was actually pulling in and out, you know, within feet of me.
You called it vibration. I would call it sway. I mean, the whole track would sway in the longitudinal direction. Very subtle, very slow. I, being a guy that came from the sticks, would recognize that right away. I'm guessing the New Yorkers immediately adapted to it, and they never even felt it anymore. K2KEY, K2LAW.
On Brighton, that elevated area over there. You got to remember, that's right near the ocean. It's only, ocean is, the beach is only down the block. And they started to really, it started to get bad where that thing was really start to really shake somewhat, like you say, when you're just standing waiting for the train. And when the train came in, the thing was really now getting to be really like a seesaw. And what they did is they went down on the bottom, you know, where the beams come down to the street, and they start digging them up, and they found the deterioration of the beams into the dirt. You know, these were put in, I don't know what year, maybe around, I guess the subway system more or less expanded down here into Brighton, most likely around World War One, or maybe even before that time. So over the years, these beams that were sticking into the ground were pretty deteriorated, and they, when they dug it up, they broke up the concrete around them and everything, and they were amazed that that we didn't have, I don't know, that the whole system didn't begin to maybe collapse over.
Interesting.
K2MUF for the comment.
Mr. MUF, give us the full call, your name, and then your comment, sir.
Can I speak for a few minutes on the swaying of the train structure?
Please do. Start off with your name.
Okay, very good. Call is K2MUF. Name is Joe. We're out in Long Island. Out in Ridge, Long Island. The space between the vertical columns along the right of way is called a bent, B-E-N-T. From home to the next is a bent. Put in 18, 19. big iron angle to encapsulate the entire old column. I haven't replaced any yet. They just encapsulate the bad parts with new steel and pour new concrete. But they paint the steel with a painting that adheres to the concrete. Like the new rebar rods you have to buy now have that green coating on them. You used to see them all rusted when they put it in. Now they have a green coating on it, which is supposed to secure the concrete a lot better and prevent the deterioration. Back to you.
It sure sounds like you worked for the Metropolitan Transit Authority or the Brighton Line, whatever, Joe. Roughly what years did you work for them? Go ahead.
We worked for them for 22 years and then retired and went back to work for contractors who worked for them. But we're mostly in communications and signal. But when you work for communications and signal during heavy construction, you see all types of construction from the beginning to the end. So if you keep your eyes open and you're interested in things, you learn quite a bit about power and everything else. Oh, one comment quickly. Grand Central, there's a manhole called Manhole 1 that's right on the end of the Grand Central platform. And it's quite a large manhole, and it carries most of the negative and positive cables for the third rail. These cables are carried on blocks of wood that are held together with iron bars. In other words, like the cables run through wood cleats, which have like notches in them. And these cleats are held onto the concrete wall with iron bars. And if you, you go in this manhole and you hang out an electrician's plier, now you're familiar with what heavy electrician's plier looks like, and you hold that about 3 or 4 inches away from any of these angle bars and let it go, it's going to go bang right into that thing like a magnet with about 50,000 gauss to it. So you hit it on the ball there about magnetism, and things do get magnetized with that type of current flowing through them. So you can imagine the size of an electrician's plier 3 or 4 inches away, and you let go of it, and it just grabs right onto this metal cleat.
Wow. That strength of magnetic field, with the modulation of that magnetic field that takes place when a train is starting, stopping, arcing through its shoes and whatever, means there's a lot of varying magnetic field in that manhole number one. Has anyone ever worried about the biohazard of that local magnetic field? A human being that dwells in manholes like that, to your knowledge, Joe, did any of them ever develop any health problems? K2MUF, K2RIW.
Well, I haven't known of any changes or anything to alleviate the problems. I haven't any idea how you could possibly do it, because you do have cables and conduits like one or like you got 1 million, 2 million, and 3 million feet of 3 mil feet of cables, and they are carrying this kind of current. I don't know what you can do about alleviating a magnetic field, but the equipment that you put in, that seems strange. When you install a piece of electronic equipment or something, you have to give them an EMF rating of it that it's not going to generate any type of magnetic fields or anything. And this thing is sitting in a dispatcher's office, which is at the end of a platform and surrounded by these cables, by a manhole behind the dispatcher's office. You're putting a piece of equipment in there that you have to give specs on, and here, right behind it is something which is 50,000 times greater.
Yep. Reminds me of my business. People are extremely sensitive to electrostatic discharge. So everything that's being moved from bench A to bench B must be in these electrostatic protected bags. And everybody's hands have to be grounded and whatever, just to make sure you're not creating latent failures of any of the electronics. Well, people will carry it so darn far that you will get 632 screws and 440 screws that are packed in electrostatic bags, as if somebody is worried about the electrostatic discharge damaging a 632 or a 440 screw. Of course that's preposterous. But that's the convenient container that's around, and they start using it. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
transorb if people are interested in trying these things. It's like a 5-watt package, and they can be ordered in this package size from, like, say, 10 volts to about 600 volts, and they're typical, like, 5-watt packages. Very convenient.
Okay, where did you find them? And give us a couple more words. Cost and these have actual needs that can be easily used to a person who doesn't want to go through all the rigmarole of heat sinking it?
Yeah, they're plastic cases. They're axial-leaded. The series is called P6KE. That's the series. And they handle 600 watts of peak power. And basically, you know, they're 5-watt dissipation packages. The package itself is called DO-15. And they cost pennies, Dick. And so that basically, they can be ordered right from Mauser. If Rich is looking for something, and I forgot the name of the other gentleman who was looking to do some surge suppression, these are nice little circuits. And they said the voltages they can be ordered from is anything from like 10 volts clamping to 600 volts with UL ratings.
Sounds like good information. Both Rich, N2EO, and Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, was looking for that. Very good. K2KEY, K2LIW. We've got 15 minutes. You decide if you want to go to one of the questions.
Why not? I just pulled one out here. I figured maybe we'd tackle one here. That seems to be somewhat interesting, being that we like to talk about once in a while antennas. The question is by this person about, it's about a, he says, he calls it a ZEP feed. I guess that was, I don't know, is it still referred to as ZEP feed? Yeah, I guess we still can call it a ZEP feed. The question is, he says, the first 25 feet of the twin lead is left as is. You then remove one of the two wires all the way along the other 25 feet of it. And if you want, in other words, he's actually looking at an old classic ZEP ladder feed, ladder line. I guess I can call it ladder line feed system. For, I guess it was the old flat top Zeppelin type of antennas, Dick. You want to say a few words about it? Over.
Yeah, the so-called
NYY. Do you call me?
No, we were just telling, we just mentioned the fact that you were looking for transorb information, and when it comes to specific model numbers and wattages and whatever, Glenn just gave you that information. Now, getting back to this antenna question you just got, Mel, NFED ZEP really was referring to the antennas they put on the Zeppelin dirigibles way back in the, I guess, in the 20s and 30s. So it really is an NFED dipole. You and I are reinventing it. In other words, we're telling people that if you're going to mount a vertical antenna in the backyard, yes, you could make it a quarter wave ground plane with a zillion ground plane radials, or you can get a hell of a lot more performance with a hell of a lot less effort by making the radiator not quarter wave but half wave and feeding it from the bottom. A half wave dipole doesn't have to be fed from the center. If you feed it from the bottom, it is a ZEP antenna. And whether that be vertical or horizontal is your choice. But feeding one end of a radiator, in the case of the open wire feed, the portion that is the transmission line open wire with two wires will act like it is shielded. Where you peel away one of the wires, the remaining wire becomes the radiator. And if the radiator is a half wave or a number of half waves on your particular band, it should play like a charm. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I guess the confusion is that you have the twin lead. I guess the popular wire of the time was using, you know, a 300 ohm twin lead. And you go up, and you actually are using half of the twin lead. If you want to say something really about how it's hooked up. In other words, you actually go up the twin lead to a point where you are putting an insulator and about a foot of wire or so goes to the support and is the twin lead point, and then the other continue piece of wire continues on. Is basically that a good description of the original Zeppelin type antenna, Dick? Over.
I think it is. Now, the only slight disadvantage is that if you were feeding it with 600 ohm open wire line, and if the radiator section, the section that doesn't have twin leads, it's only got one of the conductors, if that is a half wave on your particular band, it'll be a very nice resonant antenna. The input impedance to it will be something like 1,000 ohms, and your 600 ohm twin lead feeding it will be fairly happy with that. In the ideal world, it'd be nice to have an antenna tuner in the shack just to make sure that the transmitter, particularly a modern-day solid-state transmitter, is happy. In the old days when you had a Pi output network which could match almost anything, no antenna tuner was required. An NFED ZEP was a nice antenna to feed. And whether you fed it with 300 ohm, 450 ohm, or 600 ohm line was your choice. Nowadays, that the solid-state no-tune transmitters are so persnickety where they can just barely tolerate 2 to 1, and some of them will start tripping out at 1.7 to 1 or 1.5 to 1. They sort of force you into using an antenna tuner. So for the modern-day solid-state transmitter, in the ideal world, you should be using an antenna tuner with that ZEP antenna. That's an opinion. I haven't done it, but at least you know where my opinion's coming from and some of the reasons why I think it should be done that way. K2KEY, K2RIW.
So, in the cases of today, of course, the, as you say, the modern transceiver, you will require then a tuner with a balanced input, a balanced, or I should say, output of the, or the input of the tuner in the back, the connection, the antenna connection point will have to be balanced going into the tuner. I assume what they have then in most of them today is a toroidal type device, and you won't find the classic system that Dick is talking about, or if we want to go back to the 30s, I guess, when this was popular, they used a type of coupling to this antenna, I guess it was link coupling. Am I correct? Over.
Stand by a minute. Absolutely. Link coupling was one of them used. How else did they get a balanced feed? Even if your particular antenna tuner doesn't have two porcelain output connectors intended for a balanced feed, you can force a balanced feed either with ferrite devices of your own. That's one approach. Another approach would be to make a half-wave coax balun. A half-wave coax balun is a 4-to-1 impedance step-up, and it is a thoroughly balanced feed, and it's balanced with reference to ground, and it's balanced as far as the output is concerned. A 50-ohm source with a 4-to-1 step-up comes out at 200 ohms, and it's in the ballpark. Yeah, you're going to get the 3 or 4 to 1 standing wave ratio, but a good antenna tuner should be able to tolerate that. Now, the only slight disadvantage of a half-wave coax type balun is that it is quite a bit of cable. Half-wave on 80 meters is what? 130 feet of cable before you count the velocity factor. With the velocity factor, it's going to be close to 100 feet of cable. Because the loss of that section is as small as it is, it doesn't have to be a super large diameter cable. But for 80 meters, I think we're talking about close to 100 feet of cable for the baluning structure, which can be external to the antenna tuner. A little bit bulky, but it can be wound up in all kinds of ways, and it will be high in performance. K2KEY, K2RIW.
EZ2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think, Dick, you know, a lot of times I'm designing balance on a lot of my wire antennas. Just about all of them now have balance on them, but one of the antenna tuners that I have here in the shack that has proven itself time and time again for that, for the exact application that you were just talking about, is the MFJ-989D. It's a piece of equipment I have in my shack, and it's good to a kilowatt. It's got a dummy load built in. It's a very, very nice feature to have. And also another nice feature, too, is during a lightning storm, you can put it into the dummy load position, disconnect your transceiver. It's got a lot of cute little things to it. Nice little piece of equipment to have around the shack.
Well, what I'd like to know, Glenn, is how does it achieve a balanced output? What is the internal circuit that's doing that?
It has two air tunable capacitors, and it has a rotating inductor. It's got the inductor where you can crank it. So you basically have three controls, and it has a coaxial input, so you can use a coaxial antenna, which I don't advise, but for the where you're going to use the ladder line where it comes in, it has both a balanced input and an unbalanced input on the back. So there's two sets of porcelain connectors and two switch connections, so you can actually run either a balanced line in or an unbalanced line in. And the basic circuit is really two air-tunable capacitors and the rotating L.
Yeah, the two variable air-tuned capacitors and the variable L sounds like a Pi matching network. But my question is, if you were using it as a coax input from a typical transmitter to a 600 ohm line output where you're using the two porcelain output connectors, what internally is the circuit that makes it go from unbalanced input to balanced output? What in there is creating the balanced output? I'm having trouble believing it's link coupling, but it might be. Over to you, Glenn.
The balanced connection is a transformer. You can actually see it's a ferrite transformer matched into a balanced to unbalanced piece of ferrite and wound transformer deck.
Is that a two-hole type ferrite balancing device, or is that a toroid?
It's a toroid mounted up onto the side case through an insulator, so it's held off from the wall, so it doesn't. It's a metal case antenna tuner, and the ballon is held off on like a piece of FR4 material, like PC board material, and just mounted around that, and it's toroid in design.
Okay, so for a guy who doesn't want to build a half-wave coax ballon, but close to 100 feet of coaxial cable. I don't blame him for having a little pushback on that one. And he wants to build this toroid that you've described. How big? What's your guess as to the price of that toroid? And does that antenna tuner go down to 80 meters at the kilowatt level? Out of curiosity, it does go 160 meters. Now back to you, Glenn.
This particular tuner will go all the way down to 160 meters, 1.6 megahertz. I've tested it down there, and it will work all the way up to, 29 megahertz, right into the 10 meters band, tunes all the way through. It's a great little device. I'm trying to remember what I paid for it. I think it was around the $300 area, if I can remember correctly.
The toroid that's doing the balanced to unbalanced conversion, I said it backwards. It starts as an unbalanced input, coax input, comes out with a balanced output, and the toroid is doing that work. Roughly how big in diameter is that toroid? Make me a guess as to how many turns. Do you think I could buy that chunk of ferrite that is that toroid? Could I buy it for $20? Over to you, Glenn.
The good news is I think every part inside an MFJ tuner can be purchased. So in other words, if you were to get a parts list offline, it would go online, do a Google search, MFJ, do something like MFJ-989D, and you can buy virtually every replacement component for that tuner, from any one of the suppliers that supplies MFJ equipment.
Fantastic. That's the right answer. So a guy doesn't even have to go through all the process of choosing the right material, the right number of turns, the right ratio of the turns, the right design of a toroid.